if there are students attending remotely and if they were stuck, couldn't attend the lecture remotely. The following lectures in this module kind of depend on the material the job presented. So if you couldn't attend it, please let Emily know and I'll work out something. There certainly is Jeff's notebook available that you could look at. And we could have another Zoom session probably today or tomorrow where we can catch up on the theoretical material. Okay. So Justin and I thought that guest lectures like that are interesting because it gives other researchers the opportunity to present their research and the methods they use in their research to you as well. And then it is a bit more lively, the material to which you are exposed. Now he, of course, dove in headfirst into hyperbolic systems and particular discretization methods. And today I want to play a bit of catch up, take a step back and go into a bit more theoretical material for this. So first I want to talk about ordinary differential equations, how to solve them, how the solver methods work in principle and what you would actually do in practice, and introduce a normal form for ordinary differential equations. And then in the second half of the lecture, I want to do the same thing for hyperbolic equations, a normal form, and not go into too much detail about how to solve them, because Jeff gave a really good example yesterday, but rather talk about some general principles, kind of repeating what we discussed about 2 weeks ago, namely how to represent functions. And whenever you solve something on a computer, you solve it for one particular resolution. So you're looking for a continuum limit. I will discuss convergence and how to check that and what that means, and related concepts that are useful independent of the particular discretization method. Because when it comes to solve hyperbolic equations, it's as Jeff said, the problem is that every different equation has its own bespoke methods that people use to solve it. That's unfortunately state of the art. So if you encounter an equation in the coming year or two, you probably get told to use that particular method for the equation. So I'm not going to, and then there are hundreds of methods for different equations. So I'm not going to introduce you to the zoo of methods, but rather try to give you a toolkit for some things that are more generic than that. Okay, let me begin. And as I mentioned, you can ignore the screen. I'm going to start using the blackboard and talk about ordinary differential equations. So by the way, if someone says differential equation, they mean ordinary differential equation, because partial differential equations are so difficult to solve. If someone does that, they are sure to rub that into your face. So ordinary differential equations, they're also called ODEs. And okay, since I made that joke, there's a Julia package called differential equations. If you want to solve an ordinary differential equation in practice, use this package. It is amazing what it does. It is absolutely amazing. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of methods in there. All types of ordinary differential equations are presented in there. This must be made of hundreds of papers, thousands of people, spent decades of work, and this has now all been included by a rather large community into a single package available at your fingertip. It's not your, not just the algorithms in there, but it's also all the corner cases are handled. You can use it as a black box because certain many things are automated. You don't even have to worry about it anymore. The progress in numerical methods is slow, but solving ODEs is certainly something that changed very much in the past 20 years. But when I was a master student, you needed to think about algorithms and implementing it yourself. And these days, using differential equations and you're fine. It's absolutely amazing. That's when the mean, sorry, I'm pontificating now, that is standing on the shoulders of giants. That certain things were a problem for me when I wrote my master's thesis, and these are just not problems for you anymore. Okay, anyway, let's go on ODEs. And the typical ODE, okay, there are different notations. There are the notation that mathematicians use and the notations that physicists use. I'm going to use the mathematical notation here. There's an independent variable called X and a dependent variable called Y. So Y is a function of X. In physics, you would have X a function of T. Confusing, X is both, let's include that. And the typical differential equation means y prime of x is given is a function of y and maybe also x, or maybe not. That might not be necessary. And that means what you're given here, you have x and your y. There's some function here. You're looking for that function, and what you're given here at every point is kind of the tangent, kind of y prime. Of course, it's, I called it f, the function of y. So you're not given f as a function of x, and it would just be evaluating a single integral, but rather f of a function of y. You need to know where you are. Depending on that, you know the tangent, and you can go on. And the way to solve that is the simplest methods are actually surprisingly simple. You discussed finite differences yesterday. So one simple method actually that works, you just take this derivative and approximate it in the most simple way. Then you have y of x plus h minus y of x divided by h, that's the derivative, equals f of y. Going to ignore the x here, that's often not used. Then you solve for y of x plus h. That is then y of x plus h times f of y. And this method is called the Euler method. I don't know who invented it. Maybe Euler himself, or maybe it's one of the many things that are named after him and solved by someone else. And this is a method that also was introduced yesterday by Jeff. He called it forward in time. And there was a bit of a problem yesterday because it was a partial differential equation. Don't worry here, when it comes to ODEs, this is a perfectly fine method. It's not the best method there is. It's one of the worst methods there is, but it's also a very simple method, and you can use that. And that means you have some initial condition, and you have, this is called the right-hand side, the term, because it's on the right-hand side of the equal sign. And then you choose a step side h, and then you have the next point, and so on. So here you would then kind of move through the system and discover the solution that way. And I mentioned earlier that in practice, you're not going to program that yourself. You're going to use a package. So I want to give you a feeling how it would look like if you did program it yourself. I'm going to show you that on my laptop. I hope visualization doesn't take too long. I'll show you one disadvantage of that method. I'll show you some faster method. And then we briefly look at the differential equations package. Okay, so we're going to do some pair programming. Correct me if I'm doing something wrong. As an equation, I want to solve. Sorry, let's put some text in here. Solve particle in parabolic potential, or so harmonic, let's just call it harmonic oscillator. And the equation is x double dot. Oh, it doesn't work. Oh man. Good. X double dot equals, can you see the double dot? Mm-hmm. Equals minus x. That means if the particle is very far on the right, x is large, there's a large acceleration to the left, and so on. It's going to move left, right. You all know it. The solution is, of course, sine equation. And here we have an ODE for x double dot. We need to bring it into a normal form first. I didn't explain that. It's rather simple. If you have an ODE that is x double dot, x equals f of x, then you're introducing several variables. For example, you say y1 equals y, and y2 equals y prime. And then, of course, you get a system that says y prime, y1 prime equals y prime, which is y2, and y2 prime equals f of y, which is f of y1. And that, of course, is always possible And this is why when you talk about like any proofs, any algorithms for ordinary differential equations, you always assume there's only a first derivative in there. If there are higher derivatives, you can always introduce additional variables. Ah, and that is also something I forgot to mention. Over there, it looked as if y was a scalar, but it turns out that all the methods that one uses to solve ODEs are actually based on linear algebra. I know. And that means it's basically no trouble to use to have a vector for y instead of just a scalar. So you can solve systems using exactly the same methods as you use individual ODE for scalars. So if you have two unknowns, just assume y is some kind of vector and you are done. And of course, in practice, you can solve systems with millions or billions of unknown as well. That works just fine. So here we have a system, and let's define our state vector. Let's define a function. Let's call it f. Function depends on some kind of state. Sorry, we call that y. As soon as I can type here, and y is a vector, so when you take it apart, let's call the variables x and v. And then we have x dot equals v, and v dot equals minus x, right? Exactly. And then we have y dot equals, and let's put it back into a vector, x dot comma v dot, and then return y dot. And that dot here is just a funny variable name that you get from Unicode characters. Don't worry about that. Julia doesn't do anything. You don't need to do these fancy things. And then let's introduce the Euler method. And the Euler method takes as input the right-hand side and the starting condition and the step size. And it would take one step. And now my laptop's frozen again. I keep forgetting that I want to fix that. And then, sorry, let's call this y zero. And then we have, usually call it k. k zero equals f of y zero. So we evaluate right hand side. And then we get y one equals y zero plus h times k zero. And then we are done. Yes, it is.
I'm sorry, it's a long time. You're given just x double dot as a function of x, and you're kind of just inventing the fact that you need to track the velocity.
Yes, I'm giving x double dot. So since this is a second order ODE, I convert it into a first order ODE. So I introduce a new variable for x dot. Because I'm a physicist, x dot, I call the variable y. I could choose any name for it. Sorry, v, I call it v. And then my variables are x and v. And I have x dot and v dot as variable. And everywhere where I started with x double dot, that turns into v dot. And this definition of v is actually the first evolved variable here, x dot equals v. That's just the definition of v, just turn it around. And then v dot equals minus x. That is, of course, just the original ODE. And this here in the beginning is just because y is a vector, I split it into two scalars, and then I put it back together into a vector, which I return. And then let's choose an initial state. And as initial state, I just put the particle on the left, position one, velocity zero. You can choose other things. And then let's take the Euler step. And then I need to pass. I shouldn't have called it f. What is this? This should be called harmonic, because this is the harmonic oscillator. Okay. This is why I say don't type that. You can have the notebook later on, obviously. So the right-hand side is the harmonic. I can't type, my fingers are stiff. Harmonic oscillator, and why not? And I choose a step size of, I don't know, 0.1. Let's see what happens. And then we see the particle is still at the position 1.0, but it starts to accelerate to the right. And if I take the next step, if I were to repeat that, then now the particle is moving to the right and so on. So let's define a function evolve. And we pass in f and y naught and h and the number of steps. And then we have y equals, we just take a step. And I also want to keep track of all the results. So they have this trajectory in phase space. I just put y into a vector. I'm going to have a big array trajectory that contains the trajectory to phase space.
Chain.
And then you have push.
Wait, is this a Markov chain?
No, no, it's not. The chain. And then we return. Why is that Markov? Oh, that for me, Markov has to do with random numbers. There are no random numbers in here. But yet each step is taken independently. Oh, are you kidding me?
Oh, that was you making a Markov chain. Now I understand.
Great. So this is, harmonic and the initial condition and some step size and 100 steps. And then, I didn't want to do that. And now we can talk while I'm doing the, using the plotting package, we can talk about the code. As I mentioned, you don't need to type that, but it is rather simple. And then, of course, what I want to do, maybe I can do big equals bigger. Is that? Oh, I forgot how it got x equals axis. Can someone help me out here with a visualization? Pardon?
F brackets 1, 1.
Like that? Okay. And then I want to plot just the points. I think that was a plot command. I know I'm being fancy because I have one big array and each array contains another element with the x's and with the y's. So I'm going to have to use, going to map something here. Y goes to y of 1, comma y's. Y goes to, so this first one, I take the s, that gets the first element, which is the velocity, and that takes the second element, sorry, the position and the velocity. Let's see how that plots something, and then we should see the trajectory through phase space. Harmonic oscillator, how does it look in phase space? It's a circle or an ellipse. Exactly, yes. I mean, I guess that's what you meant. It's closed loops in particular. Man, no. What is this? Oh, thank you.
And is it like, are they both mapping y? Is that fine?
Oh, no. They're both mapping ys. And this is just a local variable because that is the state at one instant in time. And here I take the first element and you have the second. And here you see your closed loop. And what happens?
Oh, it's not closed because energy is not conserved in the model.
Yes. So what happens, and I want to sketch that, is that, well, in phase space, where this is the x direction and this is the v direction, this is the real trajectory. Let's say we start here. Apparently, we start down. In my mind, we start up. We're calculating the tangent here. That is what f of x does. And then we're taking a step along the tangent. So then we're ending here. And then we take this as our initial condition. And then, of course, the tangent here goes in this direction. So we take a step here and then a step here. And every step, we take the tangent. Every time, we end up further outwards. And this method is really bad. I mean, it's stable and so on, and it works, but it's not actually efficient. I can improve it. You can take a smaller step size, 0.5. And I have to take 200 steps then to go at the same distance.
Isn't there like a weird little trick where you switch where it remakes like the X and the V, and if you swap them, then it's slightly better?
There are many tricks, and I want to present three kinds of tricks to make this better. Okay. This was a bad idea. Shouldn't have changed anything. Let's calculate a thing YS2, where we do the same thing and take smaller step sizes. So yes, there are several tricks that you can do. First thing, of course, is to take a smaller step size, and then we're getting closer to the actual circle. And in the limit of infinite small step sizes, we're actually getting the correct trajectory. So that's a good thing. We're just making an error, but as we improve the resolution, the error becomes smaller. That's what I want to demonstrate here now. We're calculating YS2, half the step size, twice as many steps. And then if I plot both, then we should see that now it's the same color. Anybody remember how the color works?
Color equals and
it's Christmas.
And then you see, yes, wow, okay, sorry. And then you see that the red one is much worse than the green one. I don't know where the actual trajectory is. Oh no, you see it here on the right-hand side, that the red one is about twice as far outwards than the green one. So the error grows linearly with the resolution H. And this is a nice lead-in to the second half of the lecture when I talk about convergence and what happens here. So this is the first way to fix it, is just increase the resolution. There's another way to fix it, and that would be called the midpoint rule. And there are many other methods to do that as well, where you do something more clever than the Euler method. No, let me explain it here on this diagram here. Where instead of taking a step from here all the way here, you take a step kind of halfway only here. And then you evaluate the tangent here, and then you get the tangent here, and then you throw out the trial point and start here using that tangent and take a step here, and then you end up much closer to the original trajectory. Because then you take a step where the direction of the step corresponds approximately to the correct thing in the middle of the step, not here in the beginning. And it is much more accurate. There are many other methods to make that better. This will be a second order accurate method. The default these days is fifth order accurate methods and or eighth order and so on and so forth. So things are much better. But this is a simple way. I want to show you the midpoint rule as well. And then we'll go back to theory. And the midpoint rule is the same. Looks from the outside the same way as the Euler method. Actually, let's just start with the Euler method and then modify that thing. So we have K naught is, yes, this is the tangent. Then we take a step, but instead of taking that step all the way, we only take half a step, h over 2. Then we have Y1, which is the trial position in here. Then here we evaluate the right-hand side again. It is a bit confusing. Now it's stuck again. This slows me down, which is good. That gives you time to think and ask questions. Which is F of Y1. And then the real result that we return is going to be y2. But y2, we don't start at the intermediate point. We start at the original point again, which is y0. And we take a full step here. But we're using the direction, the right-hand side, the tangent that we calculated here in the middle. And yeah, I should have made my evolve method more generic, that it takes a particular integrator as input. Not going to do that. Just call it evolve2 midpoint. Call it evolve midpoint. And let's repeat the same thing here. Going to reuse that variable name, evolve midpoint. And then another thing, the higher resolution. Oh, no, I should not have done that. I wanted to compare. Okay. I call this YSM for midpoint. And now I need to make a figure where I plot the original one and one with the midpoint rule. The scary thing is that I never know whether it's right, and if I have a bug there, then you'll help me. Why is M not defined? It what? It's right there. And then you see the red trajectory is the first order, and the green trajectory is the second order method. And now you're seeing the difference between first and second order is a world of difference. I mean, if you really want to have something accurate, if you integrate, say, trajectories of planets for a million years and so on, then even second accurate is completely useless. But the difference between first and second order is amazing. Now, we could compare two second order things, and you would see that if you change the spacing h by a factor of 2, the error goes down by a factor of 4. But I think we can skip that here. Or maybe we can try it. It's too complicated. No, let's do that. Sorry. But I need to choose a larger step size here, otherwise you will not see. And you have 20 points here and 40 points here. And then let's look at that. Okay, there's something wrong here. Yes. On grid spacing. Yeah, we don't really see anything, right? Maybe you do. So we took them. Oh, wait, is there a thing called lines or something? Lines, points? Because we take a much larger step size now, so we don't really see the ellipse anymore. We just see a cloud of points here. So I'm drawing that with lines. Maybe that makes it more obvious. I want to draw it with lines. Now you don't really see the factor of 4, do you? Okay. Yeah, well, maybe you believe me that this is the starting point, and this is the green line here, and this distance here is about 1/4 of the distance from between the green and the red here. It's approximately. If you want to make that statement more formal, then you have to wait half an hour or an hour where we do the respective calculations and have better methods. Judging the accuracy of something with a plot is really a bad style, because in a plot you have a resolution of 100 pixels, you see something of 1% and everything smaller is essentially impossible. Anyway, these are time integrator methods. These are called explicit methods. They're also implicit methods that I want to introduce before I want to go to show you that an introduction to the differential equations package. So let's walk here. Do this again. Here, I started with x plus h minus y of x. You can do the Euler methods also the other way around, where you have y of x minus y of x minus h. It is the same thing, right? Just shifted left by h over h equals f of y. And then if you solve it, then you get y of x equals y of x minus h plus h times f of y. And if you compare these, they look kind of similar. And because here we have x plus h on the left-hand side, and here we have x on the left-hand side, I'm just going to redefine x and write x plus h instead. In both cases, then I have x plus h. Now I argued myself into a corner here by comma x, comma x, and then, sorry, now fixing it up on a blackboard. This is really stressful. Do not judge me. Then you arrive at this equation that is also the Euler method. This is called the forward Euler method, and that's the backward Euler method. The difference is that the right-hand side here, it's evaluated at the time x. You start at time x. That's the state that you know. Then you evaluate the right-hand side at that time, and that defines the step that you take. This method works differently. You have your state at x, and then you arrive at your new state in such a way that the right-hand side is satisfied at the new state. So if you want to solve this one here for y of x plus h, these y's are the same. That is an implicit equation where you have to invert the function f to get the solution. And that, of course, is a complicated thing to do in general, depending on how complicated f is. Typically, much more expensive to do so. But there's one huge advantage to that. I'm just going to touch on that. Yesterday, you heard the expression unconditionally unstable and conditionally stable and so on, the complicated thing. What that means is that some methods are stable for certain step sizes. A method that is unconditionally stable is stable for all h. You can take h as large as you want. And sometimes there's a conditional stability where there's a maximum step size. That usually depends on f, how complicated it looks like. And if you choose a step size that's too large, the system is unstable. That's conditionally stable. And unconditionally unstable, of course, means there's no step size you can take. It never works. You're out of luck. It's not a good method. And the difference is that the forward Euler method is usually conditionally stable. There's a limit on h. And the backwards Euler method is usually unconditionally stable. You can take step sizes as large as you want. It's always stable. It sounds really cool. It actually is. But most people in their mind conflate accuracy and stability. You kind of think that as you make the step size larger, the system is less and less accurate. And at some point, it's so inaccurate that it's unstable. Wrong. These two are not really related. You can have a step size limit where the stability forces you to take a really small step size. And the accuracy that comes right is immense. You're really, really accurate. And you don't want it to be that accurate. But you still can't take any larger step sizes because it would be unstable, even though the system is still super accurate. And here in that case, it's the other way around. You can take super large step sizes. The system is stable, but it's completely inaccurate and useless. So in practice, you can't take super large step sizes here. There's still a limit. But the system is stable no matter what you do. I just wanted to mention that. That's called an explicit method. And this is an implicit method. It's just implicit because you need to invert that function f to find that y, because that y also appears in the function f here.
Do you mind drawing a I guess maybe it'll show us the difference between them.
Oh, I can show you the difference here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. So it's the implicit one.
So you see the unconditional. So the implicit one is stable. Yeah, unconditional. These are weird names. Yes. So here the explicit one, you're here, that's your starting point. And then you look at the tangent, and then you're starting here. That is the explicit method. And in an implicit method, you start here and you take a step in such a way that the tangent is correct here. So now you need to see how far do you have to go here so that it, for a given step size, that the tangent is correct. So let's say you take a step size here, the tangent here goes in this direction. So then you would probably take a step side like this or something. And here you evaluate the tension here at your starting point, and that's how you go. Here you evaluate your tensions at your end point, and then from the starting point you go in this direction so that it's a good solution here. Implicit. So in this graph here, it looks very similar. In this graph here, since you can go forward and backward here in such a trajectory, the implicit method is kind of like going backwards, the opposite of going explicit. So I didn't plan on showing that, because that implicit method, I mean, in terms of understanding, it's not very different. It's just you need to invert that function f. So I'm not going to show that. Often you need to use a nonlinear root finder to even find a solution to do that. But there's one type of equation where implicit methods are really necessary. And this is if you want to solve the heat flow equation, parabolic equations. You heard about the CFL factor yesterday. And for parabolic equation, the CFL factor depends on the square of the resolution. So if you increase the resolution by a factor of 2, the time step size goes down by a factor of 4. For any reasonable resolution, the time step size that you can do for heat flow is super, super tiny. With an explicit method, then it would be way too expensive. And with an implicit method, there is no limit on the step size. You can take log step size, and it's still stable. But each step is then more expensive, because you need to invert the Laplace operator at every step. Anyway, didn't want to go into that much detail. Now I want you to show this web page. Equations. I know you can't read that. I'll make it bigger here. So there's this Julia community called Scientific Machine Learning that is a bit weird. These days, machine learning is all the rage. So if you wanted funding for a project, it better involve machine learning in some way. So they involve packages. And these packages are useful for machine learning. And one big advantage of machine learning is that a lot of new people got into computing. They didn't have much experience. And that forced all the experts to clean up the act. Good tutorials, good documentation, software that doesn't have any weird corner cases, and so on. And that is absolutely amazing to see that many things became much easier to use, such as differential equations. So I'm happy to have this buzzword here. And this is this package here. There are nice tutorials and so on, optimizations if your code is too slow, stiff equations. I'm going to mention that. And there are many different kinds of ODEs. I did not describe that. And there are stochastic ODEs, for example, where you don't exactly know what happens. I think you might want to use that for financial modeling, for example. Random ordinary differential equation, I don't know what that is. Delayed differential equation is a weird thing where something happened and the system remembers its state, and maybe something that happened a second ago feeds back and it defines the current state again, some chemical reaction or some kind of delay loop in somewhere. Algebraic equations that have constraints. Jump equation, where the state can suddenly jump from one state to another state. Or, for example, you have a particle that hits a wall and is reflected, then the velocity of the particle suddenly changes sign. That's not a smooth trajectory. If you want to use a normal ODE solver, you can't do that. You could try to get exactly to the time when the particle hits the wall and kind of stop the step there and take the next step. But if you have a million particles, then you can take only small step sizes, that steps here. Boundary value problems. Sometimes you don't have initial condition, but you have two boundary values. You want to see what happens in between. In 1D, that's a bit like an elliptic equation still of an ODE and so on. The examples for beginners, advanced, and so on and so forth. It is absolutely amazing what happens here. Oh, here they actually describe the ODE problems, yes. And Hamiltonian systems, we talked about energy conservation. This is the other method I wanted to mention. Here we all solve x and v independently, and they do their own thing. But we know they are not independent. We know there's energy conservation. So one can construct a method where the method still has an error. It's still an approximation, but we can put a condition on the error that the error still conserves the energy. And that is, of course, much better that you have a system where, say, the energy or the angular momentum is exactly conserved, independent of how big the error is. So the solution could be quite wrong, but it has the correct energy and angular momentum. Depending on your physics, this could be really good, and so on. Look at all these problem types that are here. This is absolutely amazing. Okay, this was about ODEs, a brief introduction of how to solve ODEs, Euler's method and the midpoint rule, introducing the package here, a brief overview over what kind of solvers exist, explicit and implicit methods. And here you saw some graphs, how the solution looks like and how the error looks like. And if you don't have any questions on that, I want to move on to the next topic, namely about hyperbolic equations and about hyperrepresenting functions and discussing convergence. Okay, let's do that. If you solve a differential equation, then the solution is a function. So we're kind of talking about functions here. With an ODE, I have a trajectory, just taking snapshots end to end. That sounded good enough. But with partial differential equations, we need to think about more how to represent a function in a computer. I hope that you honed in your homework for yesterday, where we talked about representing functions. I think it was projecting a sine functions onto Chebyshev functions, polynomials. I don't recall, probably just polynomials, and optimizing that. There are several ways of representing functions, and all discretization methods are, in a way, based on the idea that you have given a function, which could look really wild, and you need to represent it in a computer with a finite number of coefficients. And there are different discretization methods based on different ideas how to do that. Representing functions. And there are several ideas. And the first idea, is what we already discussed in the linear algebra topic. I want to call it a spectral method, that you have functions, and the functions are somewhere integrable and probably smooth. You have a function space. You choose the basis functions for that, and you represent your functions in terms of basis functions. You all know Chebyshev functions or YLMs if you want to represent a function living on a sphere, called a spectral method or sometimes a pseudo-spectral method. Choose basis functions. And then you have a function f of x. Oh, I'm talking about PDEs here, so these are probably multidimensional functions, right? X, y, z, and so on. I'm just writing x here because it's easier. And you write it as a sum over some transitive coefficients I, bi times some basis functions bi x. And of course, in practice, you introduce some cutoff here. If you have analytic functions, then of course you can do that. If you have infinitely many basis functions, you introduce a cutoff, 10, 100 functions, and so on. And if you have the function given, then you can evaluate that if you have a finite number of coefficients, you can evaluate that function easily, just plug it in here. You can calculate the derivative, any kind of derivatives for these functions. Just need to calculate the derivatives of the basis functions. And in the end, all you store in the computer are these coefficients, and you do algebra with these coefficients. And if you calculate a derivative, it's a linear operator, that's some kind of linear operation on the CI. And then in the end, you're going to solve something. This usually requires kind of a nice, well-behaved function space, usually something analytic functions or similar. That is not always the case. For example, some function might have discontinuities or weird kind of singularities. And if you then project something onto a basis function, mathematically that all still works, but convergence is really slow. That means instead of 10 or 20, you would need millions of basis functions, and there's just no way, no good way to do that. And there are some other ideas where you, let's call them finite volumes functions. Finite volume, finite volume, and the idea is there, you take your function, you introduce a number, what is called cells, and then you average the function in each cell, kind of you integrate it over these cells. Let me draw a sketch here. You have a function here that does whatever it does. Sorry, the function probably has a discontinuity somewhere. And then introduce a number of cells here. So here we have four cells. And if you want to know the coefficient here, then you have x1, x2, this would be x3, and x4. And then you calculated the integral over f of x from x3 to x4. And this would be the coefficient for that cell here, whatever, cell number 3. You take the function that might have a discontinuity or some kind of weak singularity or whatever happens here, and you integrate it over that cell, kind of you smear it out over the cell, you average it over the cell, and this is then the coefficient here. Yes, and that is often used in hydrodynamics, for example, where you have some kind of mass density, you discretize space into cells, and then in each cell, you know how much mass is in there, because you integrated the mass density. And if there's any kind of problem with the density functions, jumps or anything, you don't care because integrals are quite generic. They can handle a lot of things. And do you do the same with momentum density, energy density, and so on. Yes?
I'm confused about how this works with the coefficient. If we end up, I don't know, putting it to a power and then summing all of them together, how would...
Oh, this is completely different from that here. Sorry. So this is how you define your coefficients. You just average over the individual cells.
And would those coefficients just then be for that cell? And it's kind of...
I shouldn't call it coefficient. Let's call it cell average. That's why I called it. Let's give it a different name to make it less confusing. Let's call it rho 3 or something.
Okay.
And then if you want to evaluate a derivative, you need to do a bit more work. So for example, you can look at the cell average here and here and here, and then look at the cell averages and then kind of draw a function through it and say, well, this is a simple function. If I integrate that simple function, it would have these cell averages. And then you use the derivative of that function. It's called a finite volume discretization. Obviously, in the last 30 seconds, I didn't give a good explanation for that. But that is actually what Jeff actually is using yesterday, where how you define that discretized function is like this. That's what moved in the discretized. But actually, how to calculate derivatives or solve the Heitre equations is quite a bit more complicated. And it would probably take an hour to explain with all the different things. And so I'm not going to do that. But the basic idea is you have a certain amount of, say, mass in here and mass in here. And as things evolve, you move mass from here to here, ensuring that mass is conserved. So every time you reduce the amount of mass in one cell, you add it to another cell, and then mass is automatically conserved. And you would do the same with energy and momentum and so on. You all look a bit skeptical. Okay, let's move on. There is another thing. I want to call it finite differences. And this is the method that Jeff actually introduced yesterday. And if you have finite differences, my blackboard skills are not that good. You have a function given. And this function needs to be smooth. It shouldn't have any discontinuities. But you don't need to expand it here. And then what you store are the function values at certain points. And if you want to calculate a derivative, say at this point, you look at the neighboring grid points. And then you say, well, this one. So if you take this one here and you divide it by 2h, then this is approximately the derivative here. This is the finite differences that were introduced by Jeff yesterday. And there's a rather simple idea. You have a function that is probably smooth. You sample it at certain locations. And if you want to calculate a derivative, you just look at neighboring grid points and divide by the difference here. So for example, this would be the grid points f1, f2, f3, and then an approximation for f prime I is approximately fi plus 1 minus fi minus 1 divided by 2h, and this gives you the derivative. And if you want to know the function value somewhere in between, well, then you probably take a linear interpolation here, or for higher order methods, you could take a cubic or a spline interpolation or something. But you represent a function by sampling function values at particular points. These are three ideas that people have for representing functions in a computer. There are a few others. I didn't talk about finite elements, for example. They're kind of a mixture of these methods, but the ideas are similar. And there are also particle methods where you don't keep your points fixed, but you rather you choose something called particles that doesn't correspond to physical particles. It just means you know your location at certain points that you call particles, and these particles move. So here these grid points would not move over time, but if you have these computational particles, they could move. And I mentioned this mostly. If you solve the advection equation yesterday, the problem was kind of moving something left to right. If you have a moving coordinate system with particles, then it would be trivial because nothing happens. You just move your coordinates together with the solution and you don't need to do anything. The particle methods are the absolute best method if you just want to advect something. Okay, I think I overwhelmed here. I think this was way too theoretical here. So I'm going to stop now here with this and move to the next topic, which is convergence. Or do you have questions, comments, complaints?
In the equation that we solved for the time differentiation, the Euler method.
Yes.
Kind of using the finite difference there, right?
Yes. Yes, you do.
Is there any time integration that they use this spectral method, for example, or it doesn't work like that?
There exist these methods, yes. And these methods can be very good, but I didn't present them. But if you, what you could do is that you take your function, you expand it in time, and you choose a particular set of basis functions and get coefficients for that. That works as well. Yeah. What I didn't mention is that when you do that, and when you solve a large system, then efficiency is always a large problem. So in the end, the distinction between explicit and implicit methods is really important, because explicit methods are usually much more efficient. And people are often, they're willing to use a method that doesn't work as well, but it's explicit, because that it's faster, and then they can take more time steps or can put more resolution in places than using an implicit method. But these methods exist, but they're not as mainstream as the ones I presented, the extensions of the midpoint or the Euler method. Okay, the next topic I want to present is kind of based on this. Let's take the finite difference representation. It has to do with convergence. If you have a discretization, then you choose a certain cell size, a certain number of basis functions, or a certain distance between the function points here. And that, of course, that is rather arbitrary. And the idea is, as you improve the resolution, as you decrease h, that you recover the continuum solution. Now, technically, if you talk to mathematicians, they want you to have a proof that that thing actually converges and uniqueness and existence. Practice, that is not going to happen. So what you should do is you should at least verify that your solution converges. If a solution converges, you expect it to have certain properties, and you want to look for these properties to see whether there's anything good happening or not. And in the tutorial this afternoon, there's one thing that I want you to do. I want you to take the sine function. I want you to discretize it, for example, using finite differencing. Just sample the sine function at 100 points, and then calculate the derivative, and then see how things improve as you increase the resolution, and then calculate things like the, well, you say it's second order accurate. We're going to calculate something where the result is actually 2. 1.95 or something. And Now I want to give you a bit of a theoretical background for that. Right here, can you all see that? I guess so. So the idea is that you perform a calculation with a certain resolution h. For example, you evaluate the finite differencing. For example, let's take the example that I mentioned earlier. You have a function, a sine function. I don't know why I always use sine. Could use cosine. Anyway, a sine function, you have a certain number of grid points, and you sample the sine function on these grid points. Let's just sketch this here. And then you calculate the derivative, maybe by using neighboring points here, and then you have a particular error. And sorry, in my mind, I wanted to show you how it. Yes, let's do that. I'm going to derive the finite differencing stencil using a Taylor approximation, and that shows you how to actually do that. So let's take a particular function at a point x. Okay, I'm confusing myself here. X plus h minus f of x divided by h. And to do so, you can use a Taylor expansion, and that means f x plus h equals f of x plus h times f prime of x plus terms of order h squared. Are you familiar with the big O notation?
Yeah.
Okay. Plus something of the order of h squared. And then, since we want this, we can solve for this. And then we get f prime of x is equal to, minus f of x divided by h plus term of order of h. Okay. What happened? Why is this h and not h squared?
Because you took the derivative. Oh, no, it's in terms of,
Because if you take this, you divide by h. This order h is originally in the numerator up here. And then you divide it by h, order h squared divided by h. I pull it out of the fraction, becomes order h. That's why it's called a first order method, because the error is order h to the first. And this is the simple finite differencing stencil, kind of the forward or backward finite differences. And if you want to have a better stencil, where you take center derivatives, that is more accurate. So in order to do that, the trick is that you write two of these equations. So you expand f of x plus h equals, there's a lot of writing here, plus h times f prime of x plus 1/2, I need to write that term out, f double prime of x plus a term of the order h cubed. And I'm going to expand f of x minus h. That is minus h f prime of x plus 1/2 h squared. This is boring. Plus order h cubed. And now, if we look at the stencil, if we write f of x plus h minus f x minus h. Sorry, no. Let's just solve for this one here, f prime of x. Can you see how that happens?
Sorry, say that again. We're solving for f prime.
We're solving for f prime of x. So this is f plus h, Taylor expanded, f minus x Taylor expanded. Want to for solve, you need to subtract these from each other. If you subtract them for each other, f of x, of course, cancels. That's not present. We get f plus h divided by f minus h. We get a factor of 2h. So we divide by 2h here. These terms here, the second derivative, this term here actually cancels as well. Really nice. So we left with this order h cubed. Since we divided by 2h, we have an error of order h squared. And that is actually a generic thing. Whenever you have a symmetric stencil, then it's not just the second derivatives that cancel. It's all the even derivatives that cancels because they have the same sign here. And this is why that is really convenient to use symmetric stencils.
Why is the error order of h squared instead of h cubed?
If you solve for this, then order h cubed ends up technically on top of that 2h. And since we divide by 2h, it's cubed divided by 2h is h squared. And this is the error term here. And now I write order h squared. And what that technically means is that there is a function that is c times h squared, where that function c actually also depends at the position.
But aren't there more, like, error, like, isn't there going to be h cubed, h to the fourth,
Yeah, that there are going to be more. H cubed is not going to be there, because h cubed comes from the fourth derivative that cancels in our symmetric ansatz. They all cancel. But this is the actual thing. So what we're doing here, we are modeling, and now Dustin is going to pay attention. We are modeling the error that we are making when we approximate a derivative. And so this here, that's 2, is called the convergence order. And in this case, it's 2. And that is just some weird coefficient. And we usually don't care about that. And this is the model that we have for the numerical error that we have in a code. And if you want to test the correctness of the algorithm that we're using, of the code, of everything, and so on, then it's really important to run the code and see whether the error actually behaves that way. That is called a conversion test. What I didn't realize until Dustin taught about modeling, that this is exactly what one is doing. We're treating the computer program as some kind of experiment. It spits out numbers. We vary the resolution. We expect the solution to behave in a particular way. Here we're modeling the error, which is a weird thing to do, but why not? And then we test the model by looking at these kind of things here. And so I want to flesh that out a bit. That's what we're going to do this afternoon. Now, this is about calculating a derivative. Usually, you solve a system, but you do something you don't know what you're doing. That means you're getting a numerical solution for a particular resolution. Let's call it fh of x, because the solution depends on the parameter resolution h that you chose. And in general, this is given by the analytic solution. Let's call it f star. Star, shiny, it's the good solution. Plus an error term. And we want to model the first error term and ignore the rest of the error terms. That is then c of x times h to the p. If we have a code, that is pth order conversion, second order, first order, fourth order conversion. And to test that, what one does is you run your algorithm several times for different resolutions, and then you see whether the error, then you kind of calculate C and P and see whether you can model the error in that particular way. And there are kind of three important things that you can do, three tests that I want to present. And the first is you want to test whether your code converges to a known solution. You know the known solution, so you calculate derivative of a sine function, and then you test whether your code converges to the cosine function. Of course, you can just plot the cosine functions in your code and say, "Hey, good enough," but that's not good enough because it's very easy to make a mistake. Rather, I want you to show that it really converges at the expected order, that if you change the resolution by a factor of 2 and you have a second order code, the error should go down by a factor of 4. That will not always be the case because we've ignored the higher order terms here, right? There are other terms that we ignore. So if your resolution is 2 cores, these higher order terms will also be important. That's not useful. And if your resolution is too fine, what happens then?
It'll take too long.
Yes, exactly. And what else? I didn't think of that. You only have 15 digits in floating point numbers. And if you have a small thing like derivative of a sine function, it's very easy to do something where you actually need more than 50 digits for something. And then you will get just noise of weird random things and probably accidentally divide by 0 and get really weird results in the end. That doesn't work. So there's a sweet spot where your code converges and you need to find that sweet spot. Anyway, so this test is the first kind of test. Convergence to known solution. So in our model here, we know the solution. We know F star. OK, if you run a big simulation, you collide binary black holes, you don't know what the solution is. So you can't use that test to test convergence. But if you do know solution, it's a good test. And you usually don't care about that constant C, but you know P. And then the way to calculate P is the following. You choose two resolutions, H1 and H2, and then you get these results. And then you have FH1 equals, I'm leaving the x's out, F star plus C H1 to the P, and FH2 equals F star plus C times H2 to the P's power. Because we ran the code twice with different resolutions. How do we get P out of that? It's just algebraic manipulations. There's no magic here, but you're going to have to do that in the afternoon in your tutorial. So you should do that.
How do we solve for the P?
How you solve it for P? Okay, I'm just trying. Yeah, sorry, no, go ahead.
F star, all of that divided by the other, take the log base.
I'm confused.
Oh, I was just solving it from one equation. Or do we need both?
Well, our C is unknown, so you kind of need to kick C out, and then you can solve for P.
Okay,
sorry. Okay. No, you said the right thing, but then I started writing and then I got distracted and wasn't listening. Sorry.
Okay, yeah, so subtract up the F star.
Okay, yeah, so you need to move the F star on the left-hand side, exactly.
Yeah, and then we have just H1 over H2 to the P. So move it to the P, and then we can do the little log thing.
Yes, exactly. Now, if you choose H1 then H2 to differ by a factor of 2. And if you use the binary log, then just, but anyway, it becomes much simpler then. So if you solve for P, P is then the log of that fraction here divided by the log of that, and then you can solve for P. And you can do that pointwise because these are functions. You do that for the sine function at the 100 point. You do that 100 points, and then you get the convergence order out here and a factor 4. And this works only under certain conditions. For example, what if F2 is actually very close to the analytic solution? What if you get lucky and the error is very small? Then you're dividing by 0 and the whole thing doesn't work. So if the convergence order looks really bad, it can be either that your code is really bad or that you picked an unlucky spot where the error is actually very small and where it doesn't work. OK. Now, more interesting is, of course, a thing called self-convergence. Anyway, what you'd usually do is kind of plot the convergence order as a function of x, and we believe we're wild and ragged functions. It shoots up to infinity or zero at some points, but if you squint, it's kind of at 2 or 4 or something, or maybe not. And the other thing is called self-convergence. And it's called self-convergence if you don't know f star. In that case, you have to run with 3 resolutions. And have to, they probably should have the same ratio, always the ratio of 2 or something, and then you can solve it. And then you have 3 of these equations. And then you can solve for C and P and F star. Sorry, let's say you can cancel F star and C and look for P and can then calculate P. And the last thing, so this is actually, I mean, doing these manipulation is a bit tricky. You're going to ask me that question in the afternoon. And the third thing is the, one of the coolest thing called the Richardson extrapolation. And in a Richardson extrapolation, you make this ansatz to actually recover F star, the analytic solution, under the assumption that certain error terms can be ignored. But you're running the same simulation 3 times with different resolutions, you get different answers. And then, of course, you ask yourself, why should I take any of the solution for a given solution? Why can't I use that to extrapolate what the true solution should be? So for a Richardson extrapolation, what you usually do, you first check that you converge with the corresponding convergence order. And then in this ansatz here, you don't solve for P. You plug in the P that you just verified. And then you use 2 different solutions, one to eliminate the constant C and the other one to solve for C star. And then you get the correct solution out. Again, here you get P out, and here then solve for F star. You seem kind of tired today. I don't know whether you want me to go the analytic steps of how to do that, or whether you rather want to spend the time in the afternoon doing that yourself. I assume it's the latter. Please do.
Or P from like all the previous methods for the Richardson extrapolation? Like
in principle, you know P from the algorithm. So if you take a centered finite difference, you kind of know that P is 2. So you might say, why do I actually calculate it? You calculate it to make sure that your code is correct, that your algorithm is correct, and that you're in the right range of resolutions where the error is not too large. If the error is really large, then you have higher order terms here that you cannot neglect, then you're not what is called in the convergence regime if the higher order terms here are still there. If only one error term is important, that's called the convergence regime. And yeah, you also need to make sure that your error is not so small that the error is essentially 0, because if the error is 0, then the solutions look the same, and then you don't need to do convergence anymore. But you probably wouldn't be there. So you know P, you plug in the P that you know, and then you need 2 resolutions, one to cancel the C and the other one to solve for C star. So you know the resolutions, you know P, so you just take this minus this with corresponding factors to cancel the H's here, and then you get F star. And typically you only do that not only once. So you have 3 resolutions, and then you use 1, 2, 1, 3, and 2, 3 to do the Richardson extrapolation. And then you get 3 different Richardson extrapolations. That gives you also a bit of an error bar. Error bar gives you a different bit of an error bar for what you actually do. So what I was thinking, what you're actually doing is you actually have data and you try to fit that model and you see what these constants should be. I never thought about it that way, but it would be cool to do that. Okay, very good. How are you motivated? You want to go through the algebra of solving this for F star or for other things? Or Are you interested in taking the last 15 minutes to get started with your tutorial?
I think we could solve this if you wanted to.
If I want to. Okay. Okay. I do it once. I expect you to take a snapshot. And then you all have it in the afternoon. Okay. So the idea is you have this model and you want to solve for P, but C is unknown and F star is unknown as well. So we need to write it for D different resolutions. So let's say we have a resolution H1, which is alpha squared H, H2, which is alpha H, is just a constant, 3 equals H. Then let's write it down for these different resolutions. Then we get F H1. You're just, oh, this is incredible. You're just watching back and sitting back and C alpha squared H to the P. I hope you can actually see that. Not too small.
If you can.
Could you raise the board a little
here? Oh, yes. Actually makes it easier for me as well. Oh. Okay. And now we are taking differences, H1 minus H2, and then take the difference between these two equations, and then we get FH1 minus FH2 equals C times alpha squared H to the P minus alpha H to the P. This is more tedious than I expected it to be. We divide it to the difference between the other equations F2, H3. This is really, oh, I should have left it as a homework. The C cancels as well. But it's very easy to get stuck. People usually don't figure it out. So alpha H to the P minus H to the P. And now the trick is that out of these equations here, you factor out, you write this as you pull out H to the P from the denominator and alpha H to the P from the numerator times, and then you're left with something. Let's write it here. And then you're left with something that is equal to 1. So that is the result.
And both H to the P over H to the P is also 1.
So this is alpha H. So this is actually exactly, this is alpha to the P. Perfect space planning. So you take the coarse resolution minus the medium, divided by medium minus fine. These are the numerical resolutions. And everything else cancelled. And this is just this alpha, the factor that we chose between the resolutions to the P power. And this is how you get P from three different resolutions. And it's just algebra, but you have to actually find out how to figure out how to solve it. And whenever you want to code, you should do that. And I expect you to do that in the tutorial this afternoon. Okay. And in the next lecture, I'm going to discuss elliptic equations, maybe a bit hyperbolic equations, but mostly how to solve elliptic equations, because that's also important. And hyperbolic equations were introduced by Jeff earlier, yesterday. Okay. You have questions?
I couldn't get that when we are discretizing the function, so we are limiting ourselves to some fixed order of h, right?
Yes.
So why do we need to calculate p again? I mean, we know it from the start that I'm using the finite difference up to order of h, then p is 1, for example, right?
Yes.
So, and then we are calculating.
So the idea is that what you know is what you think what the code does. But there might be a bug in the code. And if you have really big code and you write a paper about a supernova, it's very, very difficult to convince others that your code is free of bugs. So this is one of the tests you can present. You say, I know the code is fourth order convergence. And here, see, P is 4.2, and that's close enough. And the other reason is that we made the ansatz, we made the assumption that we only take the leading error term. There are higher order terms as well, right? P plus 2, P plus 4, P plus 6, and so on, if you have a symmetric stencil, so that is the odd orders actually cancel. And the question is, for the resolution that you choose, is it actually justified to ignore these other terms? And if it is not justified, then you have a wild combination of errors, and nobody can really model how the code works. The only thing that you realize is that the model you put in is not working. And if you use the wrong model and match for P, then P is kind of 2.9. And then people say, ah. And sometimes you get a P of 5.5. And then people say, yeah, our code is better than expected, which is complete nonsense. So if any of you says that in an interview or the homework, you will fail, right? If your code does not match the model that you expected to do, that it doesn't mean that the code is better than the model that you had. It just means that the model doesn't work. You can't just get a large number and say, my code is better than I expected it to be. Sorry, that's a bit of a rant here. Any more questions? OK, very good. Then I'll see you this afternoon in the tutorial.